I'm Russ. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Sue for and the committee for asking me to come out here and share. It's always an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, because really the only thing I was ever asked to do at the end of my drinking was just go away. So to be asked to come and do something is always a privilege. I want to thank Ken and Kelly and Domingo for absolutely carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous last night and this morning. They gave wonderful talks, and I thoroughly enjoyed hearing them. And I'm always really kind of nervous when I first come give a talk. It doesn't matter how many times I do this, I always get a little nervous. And because I talk a lot about feelings. Now, I don't know about you guys, but the bars I drank in, we didn't talk a lot about our feelings. I don't remember anybody coming to me and saying, listen, I woke up with a bunch of nameless fears this morning. What do you think? So that didn't happen. So when I come and talk about feelings, it takes me a few minutes to get started. But once I do, then it's pretty much your problem after that. And there's three things that I need to talk about. And I know that Kelly did this too. But I have a sobriety date, which is December 9th, 1979. I just celebrated 24 years of sobriety. I have a home group, which is Friday night, San Marcos. And I have a sponsor, which is Bob Boone from Carlsbad, California. And he has a sponsor. And they are both very active in the program. And if I don't say anything else today, those are very important things to me, that I needed those things. They told me to get those things when I was new, and I continue to have them. I always enjoy going to other places and get to go to other meetings. And I've loved being here at the conference and seeing people. I got to see Tim. I haven't seen Tim in a while, and it was nice to see him again. And you know, when I get to go and see how AA is working in other areas, and I'm really happy to report it works everywhere. You know, and I'm seeing a lot of people and meeting a lot of people, and that's absolutely wonderful. What it was like, what happened, what it's like for me today, what it was like, I was born into a normal alcoholic family. I thought everybody drank in the garage at 6 in the morning. It seemed very normal to me. Actually, it was like an alcoholic neighborhood. It was kind of strange, but in our family, there was a lot of drinking and laughter and fighting and everything going on, my uncles and cousins and everybody. It was sort of like Leave It to Beaver on acid, you know. It was just sort of strange. But it was a fun kind of strange. And if you look at my family, there's a lot of redheads and a lot of freckles. And for those of you in the back, I have red hair, or what passes for red hair anymore. And I hated having red hair when I was a kid. Hated it. Hated the fact that I couldn't get a tan. You know, I can burn under a 60-watt bulb, essentially. And I hated that because I lived out on the coast and everybody else is at the beach. And, you know, and I've got like that all that white stuff smeared on my nose and ears and everything. As a girl magnet, it wasn't working for me. And so I hated that. And I hated having that red hair. And I felt different from my family. Now, I look exactly like them. We all sound alike. We all look alike. But it was that inside job. Nobody in my family ever said to me, you don't fit in. You're not a part of us. It was that inside job all the time. It's the way I felt from the time I was born. And, you know, the feelings that I felt from the earliest on were fear and anger. And I didn't know until I got sober that unresolved fear manifests itself in anger. I didn't learn that until I got sober. And they taught me that here. I thought those were two absolutely separate emotions that I was having. I knew that I was always afraid, and that periodically I was very angry, and the longer I drank, the more angrier I became. And because I never took care of that fear, I stuffed it down. It was that John Wayne syndrome going on in our home, is that we never talked about anything. We just stuffed it down and stuffed it down, and I couldn't tell anybody there that I was absolutely petrified. You know? People, places, and things always scared me. So growing up, that's what I remember was fear. It was just that fear. Now, the first time I thought about running away chemically, I was about 7 years old. And I thought, I don't know what was going on. I don't know what was frightening to me at the time. But I thought, boy, if I could have one of Mom's tranquilizers, it would make everything okay. The first time I told that story, I forgot to say that my mom didn't give me the tranquilizer, and she heard the tape, and it seems very important to her that I say she didn't give me the tranquilizer. She's been in Al-Anon a long time. So she didn't give it to me, but I remember that feeling that it's the first time I thought about maybe chemicals, maybe something can take it away. It didn't dawn on me to take care of the fear. Let's just mask it. So, you know, there was lots of alcohol around our house. There was lots of parties all the time. It was a big partying group, that whole neighborhood partied. And so there was lots of drinks left over the morning after. And so periodically you'd be sipping on it. Every once in a while you get a cigarette butt. You either swallow it or spit it out. You know, it's a chance you take as a budding little alcoholic. You know, so that was going on. But the first time I got drunk, I was about 13 or 14 years old, and my brother and I were down the street at the widow's house. The widow was a 32-year-old blonde woman. Yeah, gonna have a little private moment here. It's a lot of fond remembrances back then. But you know, it was sorry, honey. My wife's in the audience, so it's like giving me the keep going. Where was I? Oh yeah, the widow's story. Yeah. Okay. So we're down there drinking it, and we're supposed to be at some friend's house, and we're down there drinking. I'm drinking Colt 45 malt liquor. I believe in going to the top immediately, right? And so I'm down there drinking, and I drink that first drink, and it goes down, and it takes that knot of fear away, and it smoothed it out immediately, you know. And a lot of magical things happened for me that night that it talks about in our big book. You know, I began to talk, and I became philosophical. I got very romantic, although I was alone at the time that happened. And a lot of things happened. I got a tan that night. It was so good, you know. It was like I was all of a sudden I was standing around looking like this. Those freckles blended, you know, and it was incredible what happened that night. And that first drink, and I thought, and this is the story of my alcoholism in a nutshell. I thought, man, if one makes me feel like this, imagine what 21's going to make me feel like. And that's what I strived for the rest of the time I was drinking. I never drank, and I still don't understand having a couple drinks and making small talk. That does not make sense to me. That's not the way I drank. I drank for the effect of it. I drank to get drunk and to take away the feelings. I drank to put myself into oblivion, and I love that feeling, but I love that first feeling of finally, that first drink made me feel like I was not a square peg in a round world anymore. I finally fit in. And that's the feeling I searched for the rest of the time I drank. And I know Cliff R. talks about it all the time, that those seconds of feeling good with yourself. And I searched for that. And I'd be drinking, and I'd see it slide by. It's like, ooh, there's that feeling. And then off it'd go again, you know. And that's what I looked for. You know, I wish I could tell you that at that age I began to drink all the time and used a false ID to get into bars and everything. But I'd be lying to you. Going into high school at the age of 14, I was 4 feet 10 inches tall, I weighed 86 pounds, and I had like one hair in my armpit. You know? As a girl magnet, I wasn't. You know, it was, and I was one more time, I'm in the gym the first day, and I'm seeing, everybody's taking a shower, and I'm looking at my one hair, and I'm thinking, I don't belong in this place. These guys are adults, and I'm this little kid. And one more time, I didn't fit in. You know, I absolutely did not fit into that place. And I know a lot of people talk about high school with a lot of fond remembrances and stuff, but I just wanted to survive the place. I just wanted to get through it, and I wanted to get out of there. I didn't do a lot of sports stuff. I played a lot of baseball, but I was kind of a non-entity because I just tended to stay to myself unless we're going out drinking on the weekends. I think the only thing I was ever voted was like most likely to marry out of my species or something, you know, but that was about it. Fortunately, I married my wife, and that worked out. So, but I remember going to high school that first week or two that when I was a freshman and not feeling like I fit in there. And I remember that first freshman dance when I was supposed to go to that freshman dance and learn how to mix with all the people, you know. And I didn't like anybody. They didn't like me. Why would I like anybody else? And so I go to this dance, and I'm scared to death, and I'm standing in a room like this, and I'm looking across the floor, and I'm looking over at Betty, who's absolutely beautiful, and I want to go ask Betty to dance, and if I go ask Betty to dance, she's going to say no, and that's going to be very humiliating as she and her girlfriends all laugh at me as I walk back across the floor. Now, I haven't made a step. Betty doesn't even know I'm alive, right? She doesn't even know I'm there, but a friend of mine comes over and says, come on, we got some peppermint schnapps, and I go outside, and I drink the peppermint schnapps. As it talks about in our big book, it talks about that magical transformation. Now I walked back in, I looked around and said, okay, who gets to dance with me now? You know, it was a total transformation from that scared to death little kid into that egomaniac. And then I went out and danced that night, although I'm paraphrasing dancing. I didn't realize until after I got sober, I don't know how to dance. Although I did it with great enthusiasm that night, or so I was told. But I had a lot of fun out there. But the next morning, there was that beginning of that knot of fear sitting there, because everybody called and said, man, you had a great time last night, and I didn't remember it. And I didn't remember much of what happened. And they said, you were really funny, you were just, man, you were great, you were dancing with like three girls at once and everything. And I'm thinking, wow, I wish I would have remembered that. But, you know, nothing. I couldn't remember a thing, and that knot of fear there, because I just knew that it was just a humiliating experience for me that I couldn't remember it. And I got through high school much to my relief and much to my parents' relief. And there was just a lot of times, and I just drank whenever I could, and I drank as often as I could. And I began to finally grow. I went from 4'10 to almost 5'10, although I didn't get any bigger. I didn't get any wider. At the end of my senior year, I was 5'10 and I weighed about 125 pounds. So I wasn't really a physical specimen then either. So, and I got out of school, and I wanted to get out of school, and I wanted to go to college because in my family, they work in construction, and they're very good with their hands. And if it says installs in minutes, they actually do that, which is really surprising to me. They actually throw the directions away and do it. That's not the way my brain works. Now, I had an aunt who worked in the emergency room when I was growing up, and I wanted to go into medicine. My thought, and here's a keen alcoholic thought if you think about it, my thought was, well, I can't put two boards together, but maybe I can fix people. Pretty scary thought when you think about it. So I decided I wanted to go to school. And so I went off to school, but my huge mistake when I went to school was I took me with me. It was a terrible mistake on my part. Because I went off to school, and I was so wrapped up in me. I was so self-obsessed that all I thought about was me. Occasionally I thought about you thinking about me, but I only thought about me, generally. And so when you do that, I was very shallow, and I went off to school, and I had to be number one. And I heard Kelly talking about it today. In order to be equal to you, I have to be 10 times better than you. But my outside facade is that I'm better than you anyway. And that's the way I felt. But that inside didn't measure up to that. I was scared to death of everybody. And I'm in school, and that first year when I'm not doing as well as I want to and I can't measure up, it was devastating to me. And I do what I do really well. I run away. I ran away chemically at first, but then I ran away physically later on. And I gave up on school because I couldn't take it. I didn't want to be there anymore. And it was a time when I thought that I knew more about myself than I actually do, than I did, you know. It was a scary time. And I didn't do well, so I went home to my parents. And I went home and I became a protected alcoholic for the next few years. And by that I mean, if I didn't show up, I went to work for my father in his business. Excuse me. You know, and if I didn't show up for work on Monday, it was okay because I was the boss's son. If I didn't show up on Tuesday, it was okay because I was the boss's son. If I went home early on Friday because I had a very difficult Wednesday and Thursday, it was okay because I was the boss's son. And I was almost loved to death in my alcoholism for a few years. Excuse me. And I worked for him, and I began to drink in earnest. I began to drink all the time. And I was blackout drinking. Now, this is the late 60s and everything. There were a lot of other things going on, and I tried different things. But my alcohol is my drug of choice. Alcohol is what I do. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I speak about my alcoholism. And there were a lot of things going on back then. But I always went back to alcohol, and I quit using any other sort of chemical 4 years before I got sober, before I quit drinking. Because alcohol was what made me feel okay. Alcohol is what made me stand up and feel like I was one with the world. It seemed to be my only friend. And I began to drink all the time. Now, the best definition of insanity I ever heard is doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. And that was my insanity. I always tried to do the same thing, expecting it to be different, and it never was. I never got up in the morning thinking, you know, tonight I'm going to go get drunk, humiliate myself, possibly get beat up, and then come home and try it again. That isn't what I thought about doing. You know, I would wake up in the morning with a knot of fear, and I make that age-old request to God, please, God, don't let me do this again. And that knot just sitting there. Yet after a little while, I would think, you know, a couple drinks would be okay, and it'd help take the edge off, and I'd drink a little bit. And then I'd think, you know, what the heck, you know, I'm going to leave early, and I'm going to go get some more alcohol in me. And I'd feel okay, and the next thing I know, I'm coming out of a blackout, and I'm either being thrown out of a place, or I'm getting home, and I'm coming to the next morning, and there's that knot of fear. And I'm doing the same thing over and over, expecting to be different every time, and it was always the same. Because I was putting a Band-Aid on everything, which is the story of my life. I would put a Band-Aid on it because I didn't want to have to face anything. You know, when I came to this program, I heard about incomprehensible demoralization. I understood it inherently when I got here. An example of that, 1976, my brother and I were going to go to a wedding in Los Angeles. And by this time, I'm very shallow, you know, and you got to look good no matter what. I'd look at a group of you out there in the room, and I'd think, you all know what to do. You all know exactly what to do. You know how to act, you know how to dress, you know how to talk. I didn't know any of that stuff, but I at least wanted to look good on the outside, because if you can't feel good, look good. And so we're going to this wedding, and I dressed up to go to this wedding, and I had put on a powder blue leisure suit. Big old, yeah, look good. Big lapels out here. Big tall shoes, and my hair was really big and red all over the place. All 125 pounds of me. right? And my friend said if I put a yellow raincoat on, it looked like a number two pencil, which was true. What do you think about it? And so I go off to this wedding looking really good in my mind, you know, at the very least look good. Next thing I know, I'm coming out of a blackout, and I'm saying to my brother, slow down or let me out, which, and he laughs, which for us is fighting terms. So then I say, no, I'm serious. Slow down or let me out. So he stops. Now I can call a bluff, so I get out. Right? So then he speeds off, and I'm standing on the freeway, looking perplexed, but, you know, still feeling good in that powerful leisure suit, right? And I'm standing there, so I stick my thumb out, and a guy in a Volkswagen skids to a stop, and I get in, and we go down the freeway. And this guy's twice as drunk as my brother. And we're racing down the freeway. And then I see my brother backing up on the freeway, looking for me. And I waved to him, although he claims I waved with one finger, but I did wave to him. And we get on down the road. And I come to, you know, and I get home somehow, and I pass out. And the next morning I come to, and I do what I do every morning. I look at myself. How do I look? You know, is there any blood on me? I look for my car. Where is my car? Is it parked in our yard or somebody else's yard, or where is it parked? And I look at myself, and I look, and I'm still in the leisure suit. And I realized that the day before, when I thought I looked so good, I had that coat on inside out the whole time. And my first thought was, oh my God, I can't go back to Los Angeles. Now, I'd only been in a very small part of L.A., but L.A. was out, right? I'm not going back because they all know what a loser I am, you know? So when I heard about incomprehensible demoralization, I understood it. I understood that immediately. I understood that I didn't wake up in the morning looking to humiliate myself. That isn't what I wanted to do in life. But that's what I did with under our disease. And I remember going to my mom and complaining. I know you're probably all surprised I was a world-class whiner too. But I went to my mom whining about what can I do? You know, she said, she started throwing ideas out. Maybe if you went back to school, man, that seemed too hard. Tried another job, that seemed hard. Then she said, maybe if you got married. Hadn't tried that yet. So I went looking for her. And I found her. She had moved out from Massachusetts from a bad relationship. And we knew each other a month and a half or so. And we got married. And my mom was right. I settled down for like 12 hours. Right? Because I brought me to that relationship one more time. Excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. So we got done. We going into that marriage, and we were two little kids trying to survive each other. I was about 22 years old. She was 20 years old, and our relationship was based on my alcoholism and her fear of that alcoholism. And she didn't drink at all. If you had asked me, "Do you love your wife?" I would have said yes. If you'd asked me, "How do you feel about her?" I would have told you, "I don't know." Because I didn't feel anything. I could tell you that I love somebody. I could tell you something. But I didn't know how to feel about anything. And I wasn't sure how I felt about anything. And we started the next 4.5 year relationship based on that alcoholism. And based on my blackouts. And she never knew what was going to happen. And, you know, I already told you earlier about that. Unresolved fear manifests itself in anger. And I began to drink in the bars. And in those bars, that anger began to come out of me because I always felt like life was unfair. Now, nobody ever told me life was supposed to be fair, but that's the way I looked at it. And life was unfair, and why couldn't I be like everybody else? And that anger came out all the time. And the anger in those bars was I was always getting into fights, although I'm paraphrasing fights. I lost every fight I was ever in. And I'm here to tell you that if you don't think they'll punch a guy with glasses, I am living proof that they will. Because I had this, I'm 125 pounds of mouth is what I am when I'm drinking. And I'm just absolutely willing to say anything. I thought it was witty repartee. I was a smart aleck, you know, and I said really nasty things to people. And because that anger was, I didn't like myself so much that I said things to anybody. And I got beat up a lot. And so that anger was going on. And I'd gotten a couple of 502s. I'd made the brilliant move of passing a highway patrolman on Highway 78 and got pulled over. And I got a couple 502s, and that really frightened me because, you know, going to jail wasn't my idea of a good time. Although if you heard me tell about it later, I was in charge of the cell block later on, you know, kind of thing, that grandiose thinking that we alcoholics get into. And I began to drink at home in that last year. Now, in June of 1978, my daughter was born in that first marriage, And for the first time in my life, I thought I did something good. Very first time. And that little girl was born. But you know, my alcoholism, my disease put her in harm's way a number of times. When she was 14 months old, I came out of a blackout and I'm speeding down the freeway and she's in the back seat and she's not in any car restraint. She's in nothing. And I'm just speeding down there in and out of traffic. And I think, I have this moment of clarity, I think, oh my gosh, my little girl could get hurt. But you know, God's gift to me is He watched out for her when I couldn't. Because I was incapable of watching out for anybody. But you know, the insanity of our disease is that I continued to do it. I still did it. I put that little girl in harm's way, and God watched her for me. Fortunately for me, she's 25 years old now. She has, 3 weeks ago, she gave birth to our first grandchild. And I could have missed all of that if I hadn't been sober. And at the end of my drinking, I was a very rageful, angry man. And on a number of occasions, I was physically abusive toward my wife. I hadn't been toward my daughter. She says, I had not. But I wasn't there for that child. I was never there for that child. And on December 8, 1979, I'd come out of a blackout, and I'd been physically abusing my wife one more time. I had her down on the ground. And I looked into her eyes, and all I saw was terror. And I didn't know what to do. One more time, I didn't know what to do. So I called my mom. My mom was about the only person still left talking to me. My father didn't talk to me. My father's an alcoholic, and I'll get into that in a little bit. But nobody was really talking to me much. When you're a liar, cheat, and a thief, people, they don't want to talk to you. But my mom was still there, and she came down to talk to me that night. And every year when I take a cake, I thank my mom for being there. Because she didn't think I was a throwaway person. She didn't believe there were throwaway people. And she instilled that in me, that there are no throwaway people. That I was looking to get out. I was a very sick person. And she came down and talked to me and she said, I'd really like, you know, you need to do something. You got to call AA. You got to go to a psychiatrist. You need to do something. And I agreed that I would call AA. Now, I wish I could tell you guys I called AA for really spiritual reasons. Something spiritual happened that night. But the reason I called AA was because it seemed cheap. That's why I picked AA. Here's my reasoning. I went, psychiatrist, like, $75 an hour, and if it doesn't work, I could use that money to drink, and I don't have a lot of money right now, and I heard AA is like, what, a buck a meeting or something like that, so I went with the buck a meeting thing. I wish it was more spiritual, you guys, but that's the way it is. Sorry. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous in San Diego County, and I talked to a guy named Bernie O'K, and they had me talk to a guy named Bernie O'K. He's been sober like 34 years, 35 years now, and I talked to Bernie, and thank God I did. You know, it was back when they were still doing 12-step calls. And Bernie and a guy named Larry agreed to come to my house to 12-step me that night. And, you know, the thing that impresses me the most is that they easily could have said, because it was about 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night, and they had gotten out of bed, and it was raining, and it was cold. They easily could have said to me, listen, kid, just don't drink tonight, and we'll come see you tomorrow. They easily could have said that. But if they had, you might have a different speaker tonight. Because I might have thought about it later on and kept drinking. But they came out to see me that night, and they 12-stepped me. This is a part of the story that I love to talk about because I'm getting into AA stuff. And you know, they came out and they talked. And Bernie's this big Irish guy, and he loves to talk. And they talked a lot. And I don't remember what we talked about, and I don't think it's important that I know that what we talked about. What's important is that they were there. And they came and they 12-stepped me. And the next day they said they were going to come get me and take me to my first meeting. And that was December 9th of 1979. I've been sober since my first meeting. And these guys picked me up, and I'm going to tell you right now that these guys were cruel beyond belief to me. And it seemed to be a sport with them. I found out later they loved to do it with the newcomers because they wanted to see what you would do, you know, basically. But They came in Larry's truck, which didn't have much in the way of shocks, and I got put right in the middle on the hump. And off we go from, I was living in San Marcos at the time, and we were driving over to Carlsbad to this morning meeting. And they were hitting every bump they could find along the road. And Bernie had brought this jelly donut filled with jelly, a grape jelly in it. And periodically he'd wave it under my face and squeeze it a little bit. And he'd say, "Jelly donut?" And I said something really intelligent like, "You know, I don't eat." And he just laughed. He thought that was so funny, you know. And then Larry starts talking about runny eggs and greasy bacon, and I'm just thinking, gosh, I'm so sick, and I really want out of this truck really bad. And we get to the meeting finally, and it's a morning. It's about 11 o'clock meeting over at the old Tanglewood meeting. It isn't even there anymore. There was a bunch of people, just like you guys, standing out front. And the thing I remember most about my first meeting is teeth. There were a lot of teeth. And they were smiling like this. You know, "Hey, how you doing? It's good to see you here." And wanting to hug me. And my toothbrush got near my face that morning, I'm almost sure. When I had my best, cleanest clothes on, you know. And they just were saying things like, "We really want you here and you need it." And I begin, my ego starts coming out a little bit. And I'm thinking, well, what else can I do for these poor people? It, just that incredible grandiosity of alcoholics, and I couldn't wait to get inside. And they took me inside, and a guy named Cliff Roach came over and asked me if I wanted some coffee. And I said, "Yeah, I'd love some coffee." And he kind of laughed like, off. You know, that's the way I remember the laugh. I'm sure it was different. But he goes off to get this coffee, and he comes back, and it's filled to the brim. Right to the brim, and I'm shaking it all over my hand, I look over and there's a knot of little old-timers like Bill Blake and a bunch of those guys. They're laughing hysterically. And then here comes another one. He comes over and he goes, "More coffee?" And I caught on after the fourth cup. I was burning up, right? Took a while, but I caught on. And I couldn't wait for this meeting thing to get started. I didn't know what was going to happen. But, you know, I'm looking around thinking, boy, these people seem to be awfully old now. At the time, I was 25 years old, and they were about my age now, so I don't think they were very old, actually. But so I'm going to be 50 in 2 weeks. So, but they started the meeting, and Bernie and Larry took me over and put me right between them. They tended to really kind of crunch me in there. They said they were going to start this meeting, and Bernie's telling me that this is a participation meeting. They're going to be sharing, and they're going to be talking about their stories, which is another thing that I really love, and I try to do with all the new people around me, is I try to tell them what a meeting is about. You know, I think sometimes I forget to do that with people, is that this, what kind of meeting is this? What are we going to do with this? Because when I was brand new, I didn't know the difference between an open meeting and a closed meeting. I didn't know what a participation meeting was. You know, I didn't know what a speaker meeting was. They had to teach me all of that stuff. I didn't speak their language. But Bernie said to me, he goes, and you know, he said something to me that stuck with me to this day, and that, this is my story, so this is what I believe in, but he said, "They're going to ask for newcomers in the first 30 days of sobriety, and you should raise your hand and identify yourself as an alcoholic." Now, this time I'd gotten almost 4 cups of coffee in me, and I was starting to get awake, and I said to Bernie, "I've been thinking about it, and I'm not sure if I'm an alcoholic." And then Bernie said to me, and this is, I hold this to be true, he said, "Well, you know, only an alcoholic wonders if he's an alcoholic." And I said, "Oh." Because I don't know about you guys, but they kept speaking to me in code, and nobody ever gave me a damn code book, right? It was like, they said really odd things to me. One day they said to me, "We want you to come to this meeting and make coffee. You'll get to stay sober." I thought, what does that mean? I make coffee every morning. I haven't been sober yet. But all I said was, "Oh." You don't want to look bad, you know, when you're new. You want to look like you know what you're doing. One day Bernie says to me, "I want you to beware of the seemingly good and the seemingly bad." Jeez, Bernie, good is good, bad is bad. What are you talking about? That's what I'm mumbling. But all I said was, "Oh." So when he told me that, about raising my hand and identifying as an alcoholic, I raised it. I didn't know what else to do, so I raised it and identified as an alcoholic. I'd like to say it was the first time I ever said alcoholic out loud, but I think in the bars a few times I probably said it, you know? "Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but when I get as bad as so-and-so, I'll do something about it," you know, kind of thing. But it was the first time I really felt it, and I identified as an alcoholic. And you know, I haven't found it necessary to take a sabbatical or vacation from being an alcoholic since that day for the last 24 years, over 24 years. I haven't felt it necessary to do that. And I've been an alcoholic. And no great magical things happened to me or anything. We got through that meeting. I remember a lady took a 3-year cake, which seemed incredible that somebody was sober 3 years. It didn't seem like it was absolutely possible at all. And they sang just as bad as they knew now. And then the meeting was over. And Bernie and Larry did what Dr. Bob talks about in the big book. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And they took me over to Larry's house, and they made burgers, and we talked, or I should say they talked, for the rest of the afternoon. For about 5 or 6 hours, I was there with those guys, listening to their stories. And their stories were my story. They talked about their feelings. They talked about fear. They talked about anger. They talked about all those things that only another alcoholic can talk to you about. And they kept it very simple. And I will always be eternally grateful to those guys for what they did for me. Because they taught me the basics of this program. And they talked and they talked. Now, somebody had bought me a big book that day at that meeting. And that night I went home and I did all 12 steps. I'm a good reader. I can do 12 steps, right? That four-step thing seemed a little odd, but... And then, and I went to sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and my first thought was, oh, my God, what have I done? You know, I've committed myself to AA. Because they were coming back, right? Make no mistake about it. They were coming back for me. And I was scared. I was thinking, what will the neighbors think? You know, it's like, because I had this thing, like, they were going to show up in a big AA van or something, you know? And they didn't care. My neighbors didn't care. As long as I wasn't parking in their rose bushes anymore, they were fine with it, you know? And they could care less. And I started this journey, and I'd like to tell you that I really, everything got wonderful, I made millions of dollars, and things went really well, but I'd be lying to you once again. First 10 months of my sobriety, I was only putting a Band-Aid on it. Once again, I put that Band-Aid on my sobriety, because I wasn't taking care of anything going on inside. I identified myself as an alcoholic, but like Kelly was talking about earlier, and like Domingo was talking about this morning, is that I didn't surrender it. I hadn't surrendered. I was just showing up. Thank God for me, those guys took me in the way they did, and they took me under their wing, because what saved me was going to all those meetings. I did not have a choice in the matter. I thought the first part of the first step was shut up and get in the car. You know, because that's all I ever heard. Shut up and get in the car. You're going. They would call me and say, we're going. I'd say, but, and it's like, no, you're not getting out of it. You're going to a meeting. And I went to meetings everywhere, and it saved my life. It absolutely saved my life, those old-timers taking me everywhere. Because I wasn't doing anything. I still wasn't working the steps. I wasn't doing a thing. I couldn't believe in a God of my youth. I didn't want to try to do anything. I couldn't be honest with myself. And one more time, I'm putting a Band-Aid on everything. And I made commitments around here because that's what they told me to do. And I made commitments out of fear, is why I made commitments. There was a Saturday night meeting that I went to in San Marcos, and it was had about 250 people in it. And they had this greeting line from hell. It was like running a gauntlet, you know? And you had to walk up this walkway, shaking hands, being hugged, being kissed, and I hated every second of it. As I was looking at the floor, the only thing I knew about people was their shoes for the longest time. You know, I looked at their feet, that's all I did. And they got me in there, and then a guy named Rick Lee said to me, you know, we need somebody to make coffee at this meeting. I said, well, what time do I have to be here? And he goes, it's an 8:30 meeting. You need to be here 6:30 because we make a lot of coffee and set up the chairs. And I said, great, I'll miss that greeting line. So I kept that commitment for 4.5 years just to get away from that greeting line. Now, it was no rocket to start them, but what kept me coming there? And I got that commitment, and I loved making coffee. I can make a pot of coffee today. I can make a lot of coffee in a pinch, right? And we set those chairs up, and we'd get done early. And what I was finding and what was happening for me is that all these people were around in the setup crew, and we'd have the meeting before the meeting. We'd all be talking. And I began to find that it was just okay to be who I was, you know. And I'm still friends with a lot of those guys today. They're still here, and we're sober together. And they can tell me about all the times when I was new, you know. The newcomers are saying, oh, he's got 24 years. My friends are all going, yeah, we remember you when, you know. They don't care, you know. And I did those commitments, and I kept coming here, you know, because they told me early on that the hand of AA is at the end of my arm. I don't have to wait for somebody else to stick their arm out. I can stick my own hand out and start meeting people and be the hand of AA. And when I did that, I started to feel okay, but I'm still not doing anything, and that fear is just sitting there because I haven't resolved it. I haven't resolved why I feel the way I feel. And at 10 months of sobriety, some things happened to me that were turning points in my sobriety and in my life. At 10 months of sobriety, my wife divorced me, and I got fired from my job. And I thought, wow, this AA is working good. You know? I seemed to be on the high road to success at that point in time. AA was working just fine. I was not working AA. That was the big difference. I was like, huh. I wasn't doing anything still. You know, I was fired from my job because I was a terrible employee. Bottom line. You know, there was no I remember going to them saying, but you don't understand, I'm a member of AA. They said, we don't care. You know, they could care less. I was a bad employee. I hadn't been showing up when I was drunk, and now I'm sober, and I'm going to all these meetings, and I'm drinking like a pot of coffee before the meeting starts and smoking two packs of cigarettes, and then the meeting's over like at 10, and everybody's going home, and I'm like, where's everybody going? You know? And so me and the other newcomers, we'd play cards until 5 in the morning, you know, because we couldn't sleep anyway. And then I'd finally get to sleep, and I'd oversleep, and I'd miss work one more time, you know. So I was a bad employee. That was the bottom line. And I was fine. You know, my wife divorced me because our relationship was over. It was not a good relationship, and I don't blame her for divorcing me. You know, the thing about this program is it gave me the ability to have a relationship with my ex-wife, Diane, that I never thought I could have. Is that we are friends today. What we have in common is our daughter. What we have in common is this grandbaby. And we see each other all the time. She's a member of our family now. And because in this program, when I went to her to apologize, and what you have to understand is I'm an apologizer by nature, meaning I'll say I'm sorry for anything as long as it gets me out of trouble. You know, I'd apologize for the Lindbergh kidnapping if I thought it would help. Right? So when I went to her and said, I'm sorry, she said, I don't care. I said, what's your actions? What are you going to do? I mean, you're always doing the same thing. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Heat's off, I'm doing the same thing. So it didn't mean anything to her. What she saw was that I began to change. And about 10 years ago, 14 years ago, she said to me one day, she goes, you know, you're finally becoming the man that I always thought you were going to be. And it was the greatest compliment she could have given me. And we've become friends since then because of this program. Because I was able to make amends. Now, if you're new around here, I really suggest before you do any of those things, you talk with your sponsor about it. And the very first amends I tried to make in that first 10 months, when I wasn't doing a lot, but I heard about this amend thing, and my ex-mother-in-law, Diane's mom, I hated her and she hated me. It was a mutual thing going on there. So I heard about this amends thing, and I'm thinking, so I go to her and I say, listen, I'm really sorry you're so rotten. I was new, so I used a different language. I'm really sorry you're so rotten, but I forgive you, right? And she didn't react the way I heard everybody else talking about their amends went. You know, I'm thinking, well, how come she's not saying, well, that's okay, you know, that's why I forgive, you know? She was really ticked off at me. And so I went back and told Bernie. He just laughed. He goes, you know, you're going to have to go make amends for your amends sometime. You know, but I would hold off right now until you figure out what you're doing. So after I got my sponsor, after I got going on my steps, I was able to go make amends for my amends. So if you're new, I really encourage you to talk to your sponsor before you do any of those things. But at that 10 months, I'm feeling really sorry for myself. You know, I'm fired, I'm going through a divorce, and I'm just thinking, you know, once again, life is unfair, you know, and I just want to whine. And I call up the man who's to become my sponsor, Bob B., and I call him up and I say, I want to whine about it. I've been talking to him, and I say, you know, this seems so unfair, and da-da-da. And all he says to me is, you know, you've been wanting to go back to school. And that's what I did, you know. And the turning point for me to get me to start feeling better about myself is that 10 months sobriety, it was Halloween 1980. It was my first Halloween sober. And a bunch of friends who I'm doing setup and everything with, they're having this big dance at Bringle Terrace Park. It's a big Halloween costume dance. And they call me and say, come on over and you'll have some fun. And I said, I don't want to go. And they said, come on, you're going to have a good time. And I said, I have nothing to wear. And they said, just put something on and come on over, you'll have a good time. So I had nothing, I put a check shirt on, I had a little bandana. And in my mind, here's that grandiose thinking again, I started thinking John Wayne or Clint Eastwood. I can actually hear my spurs jangling as I walked to go off to this meeting. And I'm walking up, and there's people standing out there like, you know, penguin costumes and all kinds of weird stuff. And as I walk up, they began to sing the Howdy Doody song to me. I thought, these guys are really insensitive. And they were really funny because they didn't know all the words. They just kept singing, it's howdy-doody time, it's howdy-doody time. And for those of you who are young and don't remember howdy-doody, somebody else will tell you about it later. And you know, the thing about it is I started to laugh because it was funny. It was funny. And I began to laugh at myself because up to that point in time, there wasn't a lot of laughter in my life. Occasional maniacal laughter, but no laughter, you know? There wasn't a lot going on there. And I began to laugh a little bit, coming right out of my gut, you know? And it felt good. And I went into that dance that night, and I had a good time, and I felt a little bit of freedom that this program offers us. And I felt that freedom. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I need to do something. Maybe I actually need to take care of me. Because when I started to laugh, it started to feel good. I mean, a week later, I'm in a meeting. These guys were really funny. They were always making me laugh after a while. I remember I'm at this meeting, and this newcomer who had been new with me, he's also having a really bad time. And he gets called a share at the Saturday night meeting. And he's going on about what a horrible day. He got up. His hair wouldn't do anything right. His job was terrible. His wife was really mean. And to top it off, he'd gone to Coco's for dinner, and he lost $10. It's like, oh. And everybody's giving him that, oh. I'm feeling sorry for him. I'm like with him. I'm like, this is bad. $10 is $10. Right? Then Bernie gets called on to share. Bernie gets up there and goes, what a wonderful day he'd had. You know, his hair did everything he wanted it to. His wife is wonderful. Job is great. Top it off. Went to Coco's. Found $10. And that, me and the other newcomer were like, that's wrong. But then I started to smile because I saw the story in it that they wanted him to laugh at himself. They wanted him not to take himself so seriously. Take your sobriety deadly seriously. Take this program seriously, but don't take yourself so seriously. And that's what they taught me early. And I started to laugh. And so I got out done with that. When I was in that dance, I got done with that dance. And I called Bob, and I wanted him to be my sponsor, and we began to work the steps. And he talked to me, and he taught me about these steps. And he told me that I can't just be an alcoholic when it suits me. That if I'm identifying myself as an alcoholic, it's all the time. That I can't have any reservations about it. And we sat down, and we worked out. And he asked me about getting a higher power, because his belief is that, and my belief today is that, you know, my higher power will give me, if I believe in a God of my understanding, it will help to take away that fear. Because if I believe in a God of my understanding, then I'm believing in the seemingly good and the seemingly bad. And I'm not worried about what's going to happen. All I'm going to do is the footwork, and that fear will begin to go away. And he said, can you believe in a God of your own understanding? And I said, yes. Maybe not of somebody else's God, but a God of my understanding, yes, I can. And I began to believe in that God. And I began to believe in the seemingly good and the seemingly bad. That things are going to, they're going to work out no matter how they're going to work out. All I can do is the footwork. And we did those things. And I did my fourth step. I did it to the best of my ability. And I went through my steps. And I had to go back and make amends for my amends to my mother-in-law and everything. And I started making some amends. And he talked to me about my amends. Because my amends at first, and I heard Kelly talking about this today, my amends always had a P.S. at the end. I was really rotten because you did this and this. And Bob pointed out to me that, yeah, you were rotten, period. Because if you add the P.S. in there, all you're doing is making another assault on somebody. You're not saying you're sorry. You're just making another assault. You're opening up the wound again. So I had to, and I said, but they're going to be like, they're going to get over on me. They're going to think, and he said, it doesn't matter. You're making amends for yourself. You're trying to make amends for your actions. It doesn't matter what they think. Because you need to clear it up for yourself. And I was able to do that and work through these steps and begin to go on 12-step calls on my own. And I always love going on 12-step calls. I don't think we get to do enough of them anymore. And go out there and see them. And I finally did go back to school. And I was a single dad for about almost 2.5 years. And I learned how to be that dad to that little girl. And she still gives me a bad time about some of it. But she was too tiny to remember it, but I'm not really sure where she's getting the information, but she still gives me a bad time about it. Probably from her mom, but I learned to be a dad with her, and I learned how to take care of her. and it was one of the best growing experiences of my life. I took what was, because it was a seemingly bad situation, it turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I grew up around here. I began to grow up. And I went back to school, and I actually did go into medicine. I'm the senior technician now at the emergency room at Tri-City in Oceanside, and I've been there over 20 years. And I absolutely love my work. I love working in the emergency room. I love adrenaline, you know, and I love to get to do what I do. And I see our disease on a daily basis. I see what our disease does to us. I see what our disease does to everybody else. And there are some, you know, there are times when it brings tears to my eyes because, once again, people are saying, these are throwaway people. Now, I was never thought of as a throwaway person by my mom or by maybe somebody else, or by Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you know, when Bernie and Larry talked to me that night, when they came and 12-stepped me, they didn't look at me with anything more than compassion to take me that night. They didn't look at me as a bad person for what I had done. They looked at me as a sick person. And that's what I try to instill when I'm working, is that these are sick people. You know, sometimes it's a little, when I'll be talking near where I work, in meetings around North County, sometimes I see people, when I say I work in the emergency room, then I see their eyes light up and they go, that's where I know them from. So then I stand over them and I go, oh, now I really recognize you. But I love my work, and I love working in medicine. While I was working, when I first went to work at the hospital there, I met my wife, Julie, who's the absolute love of my life. I love my wife, Julie. She's absolutely incredible. She was working there. First time I told that, I forgot to mention, she actually worked there. like, no, we're not allowed to do that. She worked there. I remember I met her down in the cafeteria over a free cup of coffee, and I asked her out, and I was so excited. I remember calling Bob and saying, I'm going to get to go out with this woman. It's just incredible. I was just chattering on and on, and he said, listen, it's a date. You're not taking a hostage, okay? So just settle down and go on the date. So we went on this date, and after she seduced me on that first date, honest program. She's speaking tomorrow morning, so you might get a different version of this, but you got to remember, I was sober almost 3 years when I asked her out, you know, so I do sort of remember. Well, here's what, I took her to dinner, we went to a movie, and she said, what, because she didn't know I was in the program, she said, I'm a woman of the 80s, you bought dinner in the movie, why don't I buy you a drink? My mind, she was trying to liquor me up and take advantage of me, so I'm going to pay for this all the way home tomorrow, so I don't know why I'm still talking. But we went out and used one of our phrases. I really wanted what she had. And so we started this relationship with this incredible woman, and fell in love with her, and she fell in love with me. And you know, this program helped me to learn how to be loved. I had walls up, you know, just walls up, and I decorated them. They were so thick. You know, I put curtains on the walls because I had so many walls up. And I began to bring this program helped me bring those down brick by brick, so I allow somebody in, because I was so afraid of being hurt. I was so afraid of letting her see the real person. And yet she came in, and we've been married now almost 21 years. And I absolutely love her. And we started this relationship. She brought in her son, and my daughter became our children. We don't say stepchildren, they're just our children. And those kids grew up around a happy, loving home. They grew up with a lot of laughter and a lot of fun going on, you know. There was not a lot of anger going on there. And they grew up where there was laughter, and they knew they could talk with us. Our daughter, at the age of 15, had bright blue hair, you know. It's like, it was a lovely shade of blue, one with everything she wore, you know. I can understand about having a different color of hair. I mean, I'd take any hair right now, you know. I'd be like, purple, green, I don't care, something fit in up there. But they grew up in that relationship, and as far as we know, they don't have any drinking problems. Neither one of them drink, and that's how they grew up, and they talk to us, and we're very lucky in that regard. And we've had this incredible life because of the steps of this program and the steps of Al-Anon, that we've learned how to have this relationship. Now, everything wasn't always perfect. We had money issues. We had lots of different things going on all the time, but when we applied the steps to it, our lives were okay. As long as I got out of my way and would call my sponsor and go to my meetings and continue to do those things, things were okay. Her mom, we were able to let her have her mom live with us for 3 years. And it was an incredible growing experience for both of us. I got to see where Julie came from. And she learned a lot about herself, you know. And it was a hard experience for her. I loved her mom. She and I both loved baseball. And so we always had baseball games on, you know. I took her to a Padre game. A foul ball almost hit her in the head. And I thought, this is not going to look good if I have to take her home like this, you know. So I was, you know. I loved her mom, and I learned more and more about my wife because of that. One of those seemingly bad things having with her living with us, but it turned out to be one of the best because it helped Julie's life more than anything. And those kids are in our life, and we have a lot of people. I sponsor a lot of guys, and we have big parties. And there's parties going on all the time. If you're ever in our area and there's a party going on, just come on over. Everybody knows where our house is. We always have big parties. There's lots of pictures over there of all kinds of people. And just parties for all different kinds of sobriety and celebrating our lives. And I believe in celebrating our sobriety and celebrating our lives. When I turned 20, they threw a party for me. And about 250 people showed up. I didn't know 250 people when I was drinking. 250 people. And they brought a big cake. And on the front of it was Howdy Doody. And instead of singing Happy Birthday, they sang the Howdy Doody song to me again. You don't buy that in the bars. You don't get that in a bottle. And that they showed me so much love and respect, and I can never repay them for that. But, you know, early on, I'm thinking, you know, I went through that divorce, and it seemed really bad, right? It seemed like a bad thing, and I moved back in with my parents. Now I'm 27 years old, living at my parents' house. Didn't seem like I really was making strides, right? Wasn't getting ahead. My father, who was always drinking in the garage, and I'm living there, and he's watching me the whole time. When I was 15 months sober, I went to get up one night to go to a meeting, and my father said to me, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to a meeting." And he said, "Can I go?" And I said, "Sure," and it really frightened me. I called Larry, and Larry said, "Just bring him to the meeting. We'll take care of him." And I took my dad to a meeting. In March, next month, he's going to celebrate 23 years of sobriety. And I got to tell you, having a dad as a newcomer was a lot of fun. Like, more coffee, Dad? Wasn't that mean. I mean, he's bigger than I am. But, I grew up in a house where I thought that my dad wasn't afraid of anything and my uncles weren't afraid. And I've been sober with my father. We go to the same Friday night meeting and sit together and we talk. And I found out my father had the same fears that I did and he was just as afraid. You know, and it was one of those things that now we're one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. You know, and it's the best relationship I've ever had with him. And we speak the same language. And I absolutely love that man, and I know he loves me. You know, and we have that relationship because of this program. And I can never thank Alcoholics Anonymous enough for what they have given me. Because what they've given me is in here. They've given me dignity and self-respect, and I can never replace that. I can get other stuff. But I can't always get dignity and self-respect so I can stand up and talk to people. Now, if you're new around here and you didn't hear anything you related to at this talk, hang around and listen to Matt at 3 o'clock. And if you don't hear anything then, hang around and listen to our 7 o'clock speaker. I was always encouraged when I was new to listen for the similarities, not for the differences. And if you're new, I hope you find what I found, and I hope that your life takes off the way mine did. Thanks, and God bless.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.